Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Public health officials in the Northeast are looking with alarm at spikes in COVID-19 infections in southern and western states, notably Texas, Arizona, and Florida. Here in New Hampshire, the picture is far better, but as our state opens up to tourism and residents jump into summer, we ask what lessons New Hampshire can learn from these surges elsewhere. Today in The Exchange, the two top public health doctors join us with an update on coronavirus here and their advice on keeping you and your family safe this summer. We'd like to get to as many of your questions as possible, so send them in now by Facebook or email at exchange@nhpr.org or with a phone call to 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with New Hampshire State Epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the Deputy Epidemiologist and an Infectious Disease Specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Welcome to both of you. We really appreciate you taking the time. And Dr. Talbot, I want to start with you. How do you view these spikes that I just mentioned in COVID-19 cases, and even more concerning in hospitalizations, that we're seeing in, you know, almost three dozen states? What do you think, Dr. Talbot?
You started by saying that we were watching with alarm. I think that we are watching for lessons that we can apply to the New Hampshire situation. So our citizenry has done a tremendous job in adopting what the science is telling us with regards to the utility of masks and social distancing and the shelter at home. And I think that the lessons to us here with what's going on in other states is that this is a marathon, not a sprint, that we need to continue to watch the data, learn from it, and continue to embrace. We need to think together how we're going to avoid the battle fatigue that I think a lot of other settings are showing and suffering from. So, again, it's very encouraging to me that we know we have tools that work, and we just have to think about how we can enable one another to keep using them.
Well, battle fatigue. Give us a little more there, Dr. Talbot. That's really interesting.
We all feel it. We all want to get back to life as we love it and know it. And yet this virus is throwing us hurdle after hurdle toward that. We need to really encourage one another, to, as I say, enable one another to continue in the battle of making sure that we're adhering to the difficult social distancing. This is not a human behavior to separate ourselves by 6 feet or more by wearing the mask. You know, it's summer. It's not comfortable. We don't always remember it. Or there's a political implication of it. We need to forego that and again, be strong and brave and just keep after these tools that, you know, keep using the tools that we have so that we can stay in the state of relative lull with regards to our own epidemic here in New Hampshire.
Dr. Chan, when you see those headlines from the South and the West, what goes through your mind?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a certain amount of anxiety, certainly concern. New Hampshire and surrounding states have done an excellent job, I think, at working together and controlling spread of this novel coronavirus in New Hampshire and within our region. In fact, the Northeast as a whole is right now in a little bit of a lull. We have been successful at bringing our outbreaks under control. And so, as Dr. Talbot said, we have the tools. We know how to control and prevent spread of this virus and the impact that it has on the health and well-being of our communities. We know how to control it. But I think what we're struggling with now is this battle fatigue, this tiredness. Even after just a few months of dealing with this virus, I think we're all tired of, you know, trying to stay at home and socially isolate and distance from other people. That's a strain on our, sense of well-being, on our normal daily functioning. And I think we continue at a public health level to push back on that and to encourage people to stay in the fight, so to speak, to use, you know, battle metaphors here, because it remains important. And even though we're in a little bit of a lull right now in New Hampshire, we want people to pay attention to what's going on nationally. You know, more than, I think, 30 states right now across the country are seeing increasing numbers of people with COVID-19 infection. If you look at the last couple of days as the United States, on a daily, on the last 2 days, each day, around 60,000 people have been newly diagnosed with COVID-19, right? We are going into, as a nation, a second peak of this COVID-19 pandemic. Our first peak was back in, you know, middle of April, end of April, when at most we had about 35, 36,000 cases of COVID-19 per day. We're now at 60,000 people infected with COVID-19 per day. That's the highest of any country, you know, in the world. So, you know, I think we watch with concern and alarm, and we want to be prepared because we are certainly at risk because of what's going on globally, but certainly nationally.
Dr. Chan, you first, but Dr. Talbot, I want to hear from you too. You know, getting again to this theme of, you know, spiking elsewhere, people are tired, the economy, you know, needs to open up, people need to make money. It seems like so much has changed since this shutdown in March, you know, in terms of people are going back to work now. There are efforts to get the economy moving. You know, if you go downtown, you see people out and about. But in terms of the actual virus itself, it seems not that much has changed. It's still dangerous. It's still spreading. We still have no vaccine. People are still getting sick and dying. So I wonder, Dr. Chan, do you know what I'm getting at here? As a public health doctor, how do you sort of view these sort of diametrically opposed pictures that are happening at the same time?
Yeah, and I think those are excellent points, right? The virus, the threat of the virus has not changed, right? We are still at risk of a surge, an outbreak that could overwhelm our healthcare system. We're still at risk of people dying from COVID-19. We're learning about new syndromes that can affect people, like the multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children that can lead to severe illness, even in children and younger adults. But I think what has changed is, one, our knowledge and understanding of the virus, right, and how it is spread and how easily it's spread. That knowledge and understanding helps us to modify our approach as the pandemic progresses so that we can take a more informed approach for how we prevent spread and the steps that are necessary to prevent spread. But we're also in a better position, I think, as a society, better position in terms of having systems in place to try and implement public health protection measures, better position in terms of increased capacity to do testing so we can identify infection. That includes people that are symptomatic and asymptomatic without symptoms, because we know that a sizable proportion of people with COVID-19 may not have symptoms, especially early on. And also in terms of having the necessary healthcare supplies and equipment, like personal protective equipment. So I think we're definitely in a better place as a society for trying to manage this pandemic. We have more understanding and knowledge about the virus, although that also is continually evolving. But you're right that the threat from this virus has not changed. And so we need people to still, you know, take this virus seriously because of the impact it can and likely will have on our communities and our state going into the future over the next number of months.
Dr. Talbot, I'd love your thoughts on this, too.
We've been at this, really, 6 months. It's crazy, right? I mean, our life has been turned upside down in every arena. But I do think a lot has changed. As Dr. Chan has said, we know so much more. And we can have confidence in what we're doing that we didn't have 6 months ago, of course. I mean, I've heard the estimate that there's about 500 scientific publications a day. And so we are wading through those. We are paying attention. And I think we find ourselves in a battle rhythm, you know, that we have now systems in place in hospitals and long-term care facilities. Even at public health, our contact investigation and strategies are familiar and working. So I think there's been some tremendous progress in terms of those tools in the toolbox, the diagnostics, the treatments, the vaccines, and the way we manage patients at the hospital has become a place where we can have a lot more confidence and ultimately success.
I want to remind our listeners that it's a great chance today for you to get your questions in about the coronavirus, the spread of the disease COVID-19 here in New Hampshire, and efforts to combat it. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Dr. Chan, you mentioned the word asymptomatic, and there is a lot more attention on this. Do we know, Dr. Chan, roughly what percentage of people who are infected are asymptomatic?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that we are constantly reevaluating, but partly because different studies come up with different numbers, right?
Yeah, but it's hard to know. Yeah.
Right. The one that I frequently point to is that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, did a assessment and estimated that about 35% of people with COVID-19, so about one out of three people diagnosed with COVID-19, will be asymptomatic without symptoms at the time of the test. Now, many of those people will go on to subsequently develop symptoms, you know, maybe several days after a positive test. Those people we call pre-symptomatic. But regardless, that's a pretty sizable proportion that are infected and potentially still able to spread the virus, which is one of the things that has made this such a challenging virus to control. And I will say that we have some preliminary local information that actually backs up some of these numbers. We've done a lot of testing specifically at long-term care facilities, you know, consistent with national federal guidance from CMS and CDC. We have implemented testing programs for our long-term care facilities, staff and residents. And on some of the preliminary analyses, as we've looked at facilities that have experienced outbreaks, we have also come up with this number of, you know, of people who have tested positive, approximately, you know, a third or one out of three people were asymptomatic at the time of the test.
Wow. So New Hampshire's own numbers reflect those CDC numbers. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Chan?
Yeah, that's correct. And again, these are some, you know, preliminary, you know, numbers. Our healthcare associated infections team has been trying to look in more detail at this data. It's going to be an evolving process, but we have local data that supports that number put out by the CDC.
So, Dr. Talbot, should people who feel fine still go out and get tested? I've heard a lot of people say, I've got no symptoms, why should I bother?
Because these asymptomatic persons can spread to their loved ones and to vulnerable persons. So we have been clear in our evolving guidance that there are persons who should be tested for the sake of their contacts, right? So this is a way that we can control the epidemic in our jurisdiction. So every asymptomatic person who is confirmed with disease, we do a contact investigation around them and try to interrupt those chains of transmission. So there are populations that should be tested. Of course, the availability of testing has been such a disappointing and really challenging space early in the epidemic, but things have changed. There are lots of different access points now for testing. And if you are a person who is caring for somebody who's vulnerable or has any kinds of symptoms that are concerning, that the testing is available to you. And we would work with you then to make sure that we can interrupt the chains of transmission in your own community.
Talk more, Dr. Talbot, about the availability now. And I certainly think, you know, most people agreed with you. It was pretty disappointing in the beginning. But talk more about the availability of testing now around the state for asymptomatic people. Because what I'm hearing from you and Dr. Chan is this is really important. If we've got a third of people who have this infection and don't even know it, that seems to be a major way that this could be spread. So where do asymptomatic people go? How widely available is it? I know the state has some sites set up. So go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
Well, you said an important resource for people who do want to get tested is on the nh.gov/COVID-19 site. So there is a tab to drop down. It will show you the addresses of places that you can get tested. I want to be very clear as we talk about testing that we're talking about that PCR, the polymerase chain reaction test. This is the test that we use for identifying people who may be contagious to others. But there are other tools coming to us, such as the antibody test. And this is a test that shows us whether a person has been infected in the past. There are access points for that as well, but really my interest is in identifying people who might be contagious to others. So we're really talking about the PCR test when we're encouraging folks to be tested. There are other strategies to identify infectious persons that are coming to us, but they're really they don't rival this PCR test that we currently have available and shown on our website. But certainly,
Go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
I just want to make sure that I make the important statement that testing in any aspect of health should likely be done in the context of your relationship with your primary care doc. So that's certainly a first call. But there are these access points that we use to augment your relationship with the primary care doc.
Although, from what I've heard and experienced myself, primary care docs often won't, you know, give you a prescription or a referral to get a test unless you have symptoms, which kind of goes against the asymptomatic testing that you and Dr. Chan would like to see, Dr. Talbot. The state sites, you know, anyone can come, asymptomatic, come on in, it's free. But at the private sector level, it seems like there's a lot more gates that people have to jump through. And I wonder, Dr. Chan, I'll turn to you. What do you think the private sector's role has been in expanding New Hampshire's testing numbers? And are they meeting that role fully enough for your satisfaction?
Yeah, so I want to actually first acknowledge that this is a challenging space, not only for public health professionals and people maybe seeking testing, but this is also challenging for healthcare providers, right? The primary care providers on the front lines who want to do the right thing for their patients. You know, asymptomatic testing like this is a little bit outside of the realm of normal medical care, right? I mean, healthcare providers, doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, you know, usually look to order testing on people that are having symptoms to make a diagnosis. And so absolutely that's recommended for anybody with even mild symptoms of COVID-19, that people with any symptoms of COVID-19 seek out testing, and we encourage people to go through their healthcare providers to do so as a first point of contact. I think that feels more familiar and comfortable to healthcare providers. But what we're talking about here is, you know, just broadly testing people who are without symptoms, you know, looking for infection in the population. And so not all providers or healthcare systems are necessarily comfortable doing that, you know, looking at this more as a public health function. And so to support providers and system, healthcare systems and communities, we have, as a state, stood up these specimen collection sites around the state, trying to make them available, you know, throughout different regions to make them accessible for people who might want to be tested, even if they're asymptomatic. And so we encourage people to seek out these testing sites if they are interested in being tested and are not having symptoms, and they're available. Now, going back to your original question, you know, what's the long-term sustainability of these, you know, state-run specimen collection sites? These are actually being run largely by National Guard staff, and at some point, those National Guard staff who have been a huge help and assistance to us, so I want to call out the National Guard and their support for the state public health effort. It's been critically important. But at some point, those National Guard staff are going to need to go back to their, you know, other jobs. And so we're actually looking at how to transition this role and this public health function more into the routine community healthcare system. And so that's been an ongoing discussion. And so I think people will likely see new information in the future as we look at how to transition this important function and integrate it into the routine healthcare systems around the state.
I see. That's interesting. So right now, the state has set up, with the help of the National Guard, these testing sites because the state needs data for a public health emergency. The state needs to just collect a lot of data. That's why these sites are there, and it's free, and you just go in, and it's my own experience has been it's pretty quick and easy. But you seem to be saying, Dr. Chan, at some point we're going to have to transition and rely more on the private sector to get involved in helping the state collect the data that it needs to combat this.
That's correct. And I'll point out, it's not just about data collection, right? It's really, testing is one of many tools that we have to control the spread of this virus. And one of the ways that testing serves that purpose is for early identification of people right. that might be infected, even if they're without symptoms, so that we can then do our public health investigations to track down chains of transmission and prevent people that may be infected from spreading it to others. You know, it's been estimated that in especially some earlier studies, that for every person infected with COVID-19, they will potentially go on to spread it to 2, 3, maybe 4 other individuals.
Yikes.
And so if you have one person infected and they go on to spread it to even, you know, 2 or 3 people, those 2 or 3 people then go on and spread it each individually to 2 or 3 additional people. And that's how you get to this acceleration phase of an outbreak. And that's exactly what we want to try and prevent.
Okay. I have a lot of emails that I want to share with you after a short break and a lot more questions about the data, the numbers, and what we know now about some of the practices that both of you mentioned earlier, especially concerning airborne transmission versus surface transmission. Lots of data now showing that airborne is really what we need to think about. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
NHPR Summer Raffle is back, and this year is bigger and better than ever. We're choosing 3 early bird winners to drive away with $2,000 in gas gift cards or EV charging for your electric vehicle. You'll also be entered to win the grand prize, $25,000 toward a new car of your choice or $20,000 in cash. Get 1 raffle ticket for $50 or 6 for $150 at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're addressing your questions about coronavirus, what we know now, 4 months into this pandemic, and what it looks like in New Hampshire. Also, what lessons we here in the Granite State might take from alarming rises in infections in southern and western states. Join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are New Hampshire State Epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the Deputy Epidemiologist and an Infectious Disease Specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And both of you, let's go right to our listeners now. And Jerry from Freedom is calling in. Go ahead, Jerry, you're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, what I wanted to ask about was the question about moving from suggesting or recommending mask wear versus mandating mask wear for indoors or other settings where one can't socially distance. We know that some people argue that it infringes on their liberty, but we do infringe on liberty in public health settings frequently. For example, we don't allow a person to drive 90 miles an hour in a residential zone. We recommend that they wouldn't do that, but we also enforce it because they're going to harm others, and it's the same issue with mask wear. So I'm curious what kind of progress we're making on trying to move to mandatory mask wear versus just recommending.
Thank you very much for calling, Jerry. And we should talk about masks and what we know now, especially given their role in airborne transmission. And Dr. Chan, to you first, the governor of New Jersey, for example, recently mandated mask wearing at indoor public places. How much does mask wearing help knowing what we know now about this virus and how it is spread?
Yeah, and these are important and tough questions that, as you've alluded to and Jerry, you know, alluded to, are playing out across the country. And absolutely, we strongly recommend people wear cloth face coverings or cloth face masks when they're out in public places, especially if there's even a chance that they may not be able to consistently stay at least 6 feet from other people. And just to be clear, the purpose of a face covering or a cloth face mask is to protect other people, what we call source control, right? This is where, you know, there's a phrase out there, my mask protects you, your mask protects me. We want to prevent when someone is speaking or talking or breathing from that person's respiratory droplets spreading to other people Because we know that there's potentially a large proportion of people that can have the virus and be able to transmit it but be asymptomatic, cloth face mask use becomes an important tool, one of the many important tools that we have to try and prevent COVID-19 from spreading from a person wearing a cloth face covering to others. And absolutely, it is strongly encouraged and recommended for anybody who's able to wear a mask when they're out in public places. You know, this question about whether we recommend it versus require it, you know, that's a discussion, a political discussion that's playing out at a national level, but absolutely from a public health level, it's one of the important tools that we have for preventing this virus from spreading. And I think Dr. Talbot had wanted to chime in with a little bit of science or data around this.
Sure. Dr. Talbot, go ahead.
Indeed. I want to see the evidence. I want to see the science. I want to understand that what we're doing makes sense. And so I was very enthusiastic to see a review published in one of our highest impact journals, The Lancet, many of you have heard of that, that looking across studies of the SARS-CoV-1, the 2003 event, to closely related, the one that we have now, and MERS, also a closely related virus, our talking point is that the use of face masks can provide a person an 85% reduction in transmission of virus. So that is huge. So I am nothing but enthusiastic to normalize the use of masks. And I do believe that the studies also show people in general support the use of masks in their community across politics and states and age groups and et cetera. So we just need to enable it and empower it and normalize it. So this is the new normal. So I do think that we will continue to promote this. We will continue to hear from people what impediments there are and ways to make it happen and how to distribute masks and et cetera. So again, just in the spirit of this is not life as we wish it were. This is the new event that the virus, this pandemic, has caused us. These are effective and we'll continue to encourage it.
Well, and as you both know, often this comes to a head in retail settings because people need to go out and get groceries or, you know, nails at the hardware store. And this seems to be where this issue comes to a head. And Dr. Talbot, I'm going to throw this to you. Many retailers, as you know, at this point do require employees to wear masks, and many have plexiglass shields now at the cash register, although this took some time to get up and running. How much, Dr. Talbot, do these measures reduce the risk of getting sick for retail employees if a sizable percentage, you know, 20% maybe, of customers are walking around the store unmasked?
Right. So I fully support Dr. Chan's "my mask protects you and your mask protects me," but I would also remind you that there is the possibility of a sneeze in the face or a cough in the face or contamination of a frequently touched surface where you then inoculate yourself or touch your own eye, nose, and mouth. And that's why these plexiglass shields and face shields are also effective. They help you to remember not to touch your face, your nose, your mouth. So they do offer you some protection as well as the people around you.
Would you prefer, Dr. Talbot, that the state impose a mask requirement given what you know and what you just told us about aerosols and, you know, the spread of virus through breathing, which you kind of have to breathe? Go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
I'm simply going to say, as a clinician, as a scientist, and one who cares deeply about the health of our state, that I would continue to advocate for this. My role is not to legislate or advise such, but again, the message is these masks work. These plexiglass shields work. So let's make it happen collectively as a state that is, say, notorious for coming together in times of need. This is our collective task.
A bunch of questions from listeners about testing, how they're supposed to interpret it, what is safe, what isn't. Here's one from Tina in New London. And this is probably a situation that a lot of folks find themselves in, you know, given that it's summer and people want to see each other. Tina says, "I am over 60 and asymptomatic. I am planning on visiting a family member, also over 60, who lives out of state. We would like to get tested before we see one another. If we get tested now, then some months from now become symptomatic and need to be tested again? Will we have to pay for the second test? If yes, does that vary state to state? What would the cost be likely for me, a New Hampshire resident? Tina, I think we answered the second part of your question already, that the state testing sites are free. And when I went, they said some people come once a week. So there's regularity there. But what about the first part, Dr. Chan, of her email? You know, people wanting to visit each other, wanting to get tested before they visit. How do you view that? Because I do hear that coming up a lot lately.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I want to maybe go back to some of the comments I made earlier, that testing is one tool that we have in our toolkit for trying to prevent the spread of COVID-19. And so testing certainly is available for Tina or for anybody else who wants to get tested, whether they just want to know if they're potentially infected or if they're thinking about traveling to visit someone else and want to try and be, you know, as protective as possible against, you know, spreading COVID-19 between people or between communities. But testing only gives you one point in time, one snapshot of whether someone might be infected or not, right? And so there are inherent limitations to testing in that someone could be tested and then go on to develop infection later on, whether that's days or weeks after a negative test. And so even if someone is tested and they test negative, it still remains important for people to implement the other tools in our toolkit, so to speak. And that is what people hear us frequently talk about, which is, you know, even when visiting someone else, try and stay outdoors as much as possible, practice good hand hygiene, don't go and visit if you're feeling, you or the other person are feeling sick or having any symptoms, cover if you're coughs and sneezes. And what we were just talking about, wear a cloth face mask, especially if you're going to be within 6 feet of someone else, and try and stay at least 6 feet away as much as possible. You know, avoid physical contact and close contact within 6 feet. All of those measures remain critically important for controlling this pandemic coronavirus. Even if someone is tested and they test negative, those measures are still important.
Yeah, Cynthia wrote an email kind of related to what Tina asked. Cynthia says, you know, can the doctors address the issue that test results are accurate for the moment in time of the test? Cynthia says, I'm hearing more and more people say, I was tested, I'm fine, weeks after they were tested. There seems to be a belief that you only get tested once, you're negative, and you're good to go indefinitely. So I think, Cynthia, thank you for writing in. And Dr. Chan, I think you just address that. Here's another one from Beth in Nottingham, who says, what are their thoughts about the risk of aerosols and how this may relate to reopening schools? Beth, thank you for raising that. We need to talk about it. To you first, Dr. Talbot, just to remind us, people, not everybody might not know what aerosols are and what their role is in this virus.
So we have classified diseases in certain ways that then informs the way we try to prevent transmission person to person. So diseases that transmit through the airborne route are those where a person puts a very, very tiny bit of infectious pathogen into the air, and it can linger there for hours. And you can see that that's a massive threat to us. For that reason, we recommend a higher level of mask, especially for healthcare workers who are in a closed circumstance with those patients. The other is this droplet transmissible disease. So these are larger droplets that emanate from a sick person's mouth when they cough or sneeze, and these fall quickly to the earth. So again, the classification of a disease as a airborne transmissible or a droplet transmissible is really for the purpose of the package of interventions we take around each. But in fact, the organisms haven't fully read the textbooks, you know, and we've said all along, 6 feet is a bit of a magic number, two arms length from someone, because the predominant mechanism of transmission of the COVID-19 virus is through droplets. We know that. There's no question about that. These are large droplets that fall to the earth generally within 6 feet. Yeah. is it possible in a very closed space, in close contact, that there might be a particle that remains in the air and transmits through airborne? That's the headlines we're seeing right now. There were 239 scientists from 32 countries that wrote an open letter to the World Health Organization suggesting that airborne transmission may be playing a larger role in the propagation of this pandemic. So that's why you're seeing this in all the media outlets right now. I want to keep coming back to this. Respiratory droplets are the main driver of this transmission in our state. And so our usual mechanisms are doing the job we expect, that is the masks and the social distancing. So please follow up on that, Dr. Chan. I know you thought...
Well, yeah, and I do want you to follow up, Dr. Chan, and I'll add a little something to that. There has been so much emphasis as businesses open up on cleaning and sanitizing, and obviously it's welcome. You know, we all want things to be clean. I do wonder, Dr. Chan, if there's sort of an overemphasis there on look how much we're wiping everything down and an underemphasis on stay 6 feet apart, wear a mask.
Yeah, and I think these questions highlight the fact or the questions that we've frequently gotten of how is this virus really transmitted? And I think we keep coming back to the point that we believe that the science shows us that this virus is primarily transmitted through droplet transmission, large respiratory droplets that people come into contact with when they are within 6 feet of someone else. Now, is it possible that there could be aerosols generated that spread further distances? Yes, and we have always acknowledged that, and CDC has always acknowledged that in the guidance out there, for example, requiring higher level mask protection in the healthcare setting when there are aerosol generating procedures done in the healthcare setting, or even certain situations that could potentially create aerosols in the community, like choirs and singing groups, right? There have been reports of high attack rates of infections in, you know, choir and singing practices because of the vibration of the vocal cords theoretically could potentially, you know, aerosolize small, you know, respiratory droplets that fit, spread further distances than 6 feet. So we have, and this is also incorporated in a lot of the guidance that's out there for businesses and societal functioning. We have always acknowledged the potential for aerosol transmission, but the predominant way that we believe this virus transmits still is close contact through someone's respiratory droplets. Now, to your other question about, well, what about surfaces? What about fomites? And that is also another way that potentially could spread the virus, right? So somebody wipes their nose with their hand, comes along and touches a handle or a doorknob, and that person's infected with COVID-19, someone could come along and touch that same surface, especially if it's within, you know, minutes, hours, potentially days after someone else comes along and, you know, touches that and then touches their eyes, nose, mouth, they could potentially infect themselves. The risk is probably highest, in the minutes to hours after someone touches that surface. But again, this is another potential risk, but not the main way that we believe the virus is primarily transmitted. And so, again, when we're looking at a toolbox of interventions for how we can prevent this virus from spreading and keeping people as safe as possible, cleaning and disinfection becomes one of the important tools that we have to try and prevent that possibility of surface-to-person fomite transmission. But again, the primary way that we believe this virus is being spread is close person-to-person contact within 6 feet.
I want to ask both of you about racial minorities here in New Hampshire and how we have seen grim numbers concerning non-white Americans and their experience with this disease. As you both know, Black and Latinx people facing much higher rates of infection, more serious illness for a number of reasons, including higher proportion of these populations working in essential jobs that create exposure, implicit bias in medicine, substandard care. Dr. Chan, you first, just recognizing this fact, what steps would you like to see either the State Department of Health and Human Services take, or city public health departments, or individual healthcare providers People keep saying we're all in this together. So what should be the community response to these concerning numbers about non-white Granite Staters?
Yeah, and I think that first off, let me say that I'm glad to see increased attention on this issue, right? The racial and ethnic disparity issue, because I think it highlights something that is not unique to COVID-19. And given that New Hampshire is a predominantly white state, I think that it's easier potentially for us and people in our communities to not have this issue confront us as much as it potentially does in other states that have a greater diversity. But this is an issue that is affecting everybody, all states, all communities. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic has brought out the disparity issue and brought it front and center more prominently. And I think we need to address it, right? Because it's not just an issue with COVID-19. It's an issue for overall population health, how people, access health care, the natural and built environment that they live in and how those impact health, behavioral, economic risk factors for how people can stay healthy in our communities. And these are well acknowledged and well supported disparities that are present, not only in New Hampshire, but across the country. And so I'm happy to see that this is getting more attention. I'm glad to see that, the state has set up, I forget the official term, a task force or a group looking into these issues. Likewise at a public health level, in our incident management response to this, we've tried to bring on people to help look at this issue of, racial and ethnic disparities and how we can address that issue. But I want to acknowledge that this is a much larger problem that is not going to be fixed right away during the COVID-19 pandemic. But I'm glad to see this getting more attention, because hopefully this is going to be a starting point to see more change in these issues and, people talking and addressing these issues in a greater frequency.
We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to dig into some of the demographics a little bit more with both of you, what we know. Also, I'd like to ask about news on a vaccine, on better treatment so people don't get quite so sick and even die from this disease. And we'll take a lot more of your emails too. So keep them coming in, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, the state's top public health doctors on the status of coronavirus in New Hampshire. We're looking at the numbers, the trends, and what progress they see. Also, their advice on keeping yourself safe this summer. Let's hear from you. It's a great chance to get your questions answered by email exchange@nhpr.org or phone call 1-800-892-6477. And our guests are Dr. Benjamin Chan, he's the state epidemiologist, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Couple more questions on who is getting this virus here in New Hampshire, among what populations is it spreading. Dr. Chan, the state refreshes its COVID-19 numbers every day, so it's a snapshot in time, as you both described earlier. How can, Dr. Chan, the public measure the progression of infection and disease over time so we can see the trends rising or falling among different demographic groups?
People, again, to our website, nh.gov/COVID-19, that's a /COVID-19. We have a data dashboard that is linked off of the homepage, which displays a bunch of demographic information, trend data, our epidemic curve graphed out, so to speak. And so we encourage people to go on there and look at the data that we've made currently publicly available, and that gets updated on a daily basis. I will mention that this dashboard is looking at undergoing an update in the next week or two, where we are going to be bringing online more trend data, like looking at progression, so not necessarily demographic data, cross-sectional data, but looking at the trend of various data points, which becomes much more important when we're talking about how is this outbreak, how is this pandemic progressing in New Hampshire, right? We really need to look at trend data. And there's a few different data points that we look at that become important because the infection has, a COVID-19 infection has different stages, right? Early on, people may have mild symptoms where they seek testing. Some people will go on to develop more severe illness and require hospitalization. And then some people with more severe illness, a subset of those people will subsequently go on and potentially die from COVID-19, one of the unfortunate outcomes of COVID-19. I think we have more than 130,000 people in the United States so far that have died from COVID-19. So we look at all of those data points along this trajectory of infection, so to speak, to get an idea for how COVID-19 is transmitting in our community, right? We look at the total number of people who are, you know, test positive for COVID-19 and the percentage of tests that are positive. We're down currently at about, you know, 2% or so of our PCR-based nasal swabs that are positive for COVID-19, a pretty low number. We also look at hospitalizations as an indicator of community spread, and then we have information on the impact of COVID-19 on death or the death rate. And all of those data points are important to look at to really more fully understand how COVID-19 is spreading in our community. We're going to be trying to make that kind of data more available in the next week or two.
So a little more meaningful in terms of looking at trends. And I wonder, Dr. Talbot, what you are seeing among the demographic age 20 to 29, because as you know, Dr. Talbot, there's rising concern about infection rates among this demographic in other states.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, I find it a very interesting science that and perhaps somewhat reassuring that children in the younger age groups are less likely to be infected and maybe less likely to transmit. But by the time you're an adult in the age group you've suggested, Laura, these persons are fully capable of transmitting virus, especially concerning to those who are vulnerable from to bad disease and death even. So it's a very important population who perhaps underappreciates their role in transmission and propagation of this epidemic. So it's critically important to have appropriate messaging out that they too need to adhere to sort of avoiding the three C's, closed spaces, crowds, and close contact with people. And I'm afraid that what I'm hearing that appears to be driving some of the Florida tragedy is just those things. So closed spaces, crowds, and close contact in places like nightclubs and parties. So there is a very important lesson for us to translate to action, that it's likely this virus enjoys and exploits that situation of the party or nightclub. And we need to intervene on that as we can through education, because that age group has an important role in propagating this epidemic.
Well, lots of questions from our listeners, and we only have about 5 minutes left, so I'll try to roll through a couple of these. Tricia is calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Tricia, you're on the air. Welcome. Thank you for being with us. Tricia,
hello.
Good morning. Are you on the air? Yeah, go ahead, Tricia.
Yes. So my question, I'm from Peterborough, and my question is that I hear that in Portsmouth there is going to be a rally of the president. And I fear that this is an unnecessary risk to the residents of New Hampshire, even though masks are suggested or encouraged, they're not going to be required. I realize it's supposed to be outside, but it still feels to me that New Hampshire has been doing a very good job in the state so far in by keeping things tight and closed down and following the science. And now we're having this large gathering, and I know that it has a little bit of a political tone here, but I'm wondering if this is an unnecessary risk of spreading the virus to
Tricia,
New Hampshire.
Thank you for calling, Tricia, and Dr. Talbot, what is your advice to someone who might attend President Trump's rally in Portsmouth today, addressing, you know, Tricia's concerns as well about spread?
Let's back up to making sure you decide whether you're the right person to take this risk. So, for example, if you have medical comorbidities, if you have diabetes, if you have chronic lung disease, if you're at an extreme of age, even over 60, I think it's a bad idea to go to any place where there are crowds and potential for close contact with people who aren't masked. So think about that very carefully before you attend that barbecue or that protest or that rally. And then if you've taken the decision that you are somebody who will go to such, it would be in breach of everything we've just said not to embrace your mask, right, full time, to have your Purell, your alcohol-based hand rub in each pocket of your jeans, right? You need to use it. You need to try to keep your 6 feet. And we cannot say this strongly enough, right?
Dr. Chan, to Tricia's point about people coming in from out of state, we got a lot of questions from listeners before the show concerned about not just people coming in from out of state for the rally, but for tourism in general. And as you know, restrictions have come off tourism recently. Hotels are now allowed to operate at 100% capacity. How is the state going to handle this safely, Dr. Chan? We have heard a lot of concerns about this. Visitors from elsewhere, do they need to quarantine? And realistically, how many people really quarantine for 2 weeks if they're only here for a week? I just wonder if you can address broader concerns about people coming in from out of state. This is a big, big deal in New Hampshire in the summer.
Yeah, and that's a concern that we have certainly heard and understand, especially given the national outbreak picture and the acceleration of COVID-19 in many other areas of the country, right? Travel poses a risk, both to New Hampshire residents traveling out of the state and other non-New Hampshire residents coming into the state. You know, I think the good news is that the New England states as a whole have seen a substantial and ongoing decrease for low levels of community transmission. And so risk of people from New England bringing COVID-19 into the state certainly is much lower than it had been because of New England's situation.
Does that include Massachusetts, Dr.
Yes,
Chan?
Yes, that includes Massachusetts. Massachusetts has, similar to, you know, even Connecticut, Rhode Island, substantial decreases in the level of community transmission. The Northeast as a whole has done very well, and we want to try and keep it that way. And so, you know, this issue of, you know, travel is challenging, right? Because we don't have the ability to, you know, completely restrict people from coming into our state. And I think this goes back to, you know, the recommendation that people who are coming from outside of New England, and the governor announced this last week, I think, that people coming from outside of the six, you know, New England states, need to quarantine for 14 days if they are going to stay in the state. Now, to your point, while people may not do that, you know, that is the recommendation. That is what we ask people to do. And I think it goes back to, you know, what we've talked about earlier is that we can't rely on any one measure to control spread of this virus. And so, you know, we need everybody, whether they're coming into New Hampshire from out of state or New Hampshire residents, to continue to follow the recommendations around physical distancing, cloth face mask use, hand hygiene, you know, staying home if someone's sick, getting tested if they're having any symptoms. It becomes important to implement this package, this toolkit of measures in their entirety to help control this virus.
Speaking of tourism, Dr. Talbot, here we are, full summer, and it isn't just the tourists who love New Hampshire in the summer. Of course, many of us Granite Staters have our favorite summer traditions, you know, our neighborhood cookouts, our trips to a special place, our hikes and so forth. Just on a more personal level, Dr. Talbot, what feels okay to you this summer and what doesn't feel okay?
It feels great, not just okay, to get out in nature, you know, to be with the sun shining, that kills the virus, by the way, the breeze, which moves it away from us, and in solitude, in small, safe bubbles of people who are not a risk to you. So it feels so great to do a hike and to be able to take your mask off because there's no one else around, and just to be able to, you know, experience the beauty of our state. So what doesn't feel good is the indoor events, the barbecues where people are clustered in close condition, and because these are loved ones and these are neighbors and good friends, forgetting about our masks because it feels awkward, right? It's not the normal of the way we interact with one another. So, you know, those extremes. The more you're separated, you're outside, you're not in close contact in closed spaces and in crowds, great. The less so, I think you really need to mitigate that risk using the mask and the hand hygiene, and just keep thinking about that 2 arms length from everyone.
Dr. Chan, I understand you're a big hiker. What feels okay to you this summer and what doesn't feel okay? And we just have about 30 seconds left.
Sure. Yeah, I would echo what Dr. Talbot said. You know, outdoors, small groups with people you know, I would still avoid, I still recommend people avoid large gatherings where the risk is greater. But people certainly are free to make their own choices. And so if people are out in public places, please continue to wear cloth face coverings and stay that those 2 arm lengths away from other people. And if anybody is having symptoms, even mild symptoms of COVID-19, they should be tested. But generally, outdoors, small group activities, enjoy the outdoors while we have it.
Yeah, while we have it. Well, we will talk to both of you again. For now, I really appreciate you being with us. There's a lot more we could have covered, but thank you for your time, both of you.
Thank you very much.
That's New Hampshire's state epidemiologist, Dr. Benjamin Chan, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist. And you've been listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.